Good afternoon, and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two oral arguments on our docket this afternoon and four cases to be submitted without argument. Yeah, that's right. And if you're ready, I will ask our deputy clerk to call the first case, and I believe that lawyers on both sides have asked for their full time, and so it'll be probably about 40 minutes before we get to the second case. So with that, I'll ask Bonnie to read out.
The court will now call U.S. Capital Investments, LLC, et al. Versus Sean Chabazi, et al. May it please the court, Mr. G. Scott Williams will argue for the appellant. Mr. Richard H. Kelsey will argue for the appellate.
Ready?
Yes.
Okay, proceed then.
My name is G. Scott Williams, and I represent the appellants, U.S. Capital Investments, LLC, who I'll call U.S. Capital, and Masood Danish Paju, who goes by the name Danish Paju, and that's what I'll call him. What I would like to do and focus on today is what I consider to be the most important issues of this appeal, the applicability and enforceability of the alleged disclaimer of reliance provision signed by U.S. Capital. The trial court's decision on those two issues resulted in two errors, I believe. One, the entry of a partial directed verdict as to U.S. Capital's fraud and reliance claims and affirmative defenses. And two, the disregarding of jury question number 8, which found that Danish Paju was excused from performing the guarantee because the guarantee was procured by fraud. Those rulings changed the entire case. Because one, it allowed the appellee, one of the appellees, Royal West, to recover on damage to which it was not justly entitled because the lease and the guarantee agreement, which was the only basis of the damages found by the trial court, those were procured by fraud. And had we been able to submit fraud questions, we believe those would have been knocked out, just as the jury found as to the guarantee. Two, it precluded U.S. Capital from recovering its damages caused by the appellee's fraud. So we have us not being able to recover our own damages and us being precluded from asserting fraud as a defense to the fraud and guarantee claims. It's important to note that at the hearing on the motion to disregard the jury question number 8, Judge Wallace stated on the record, "If it had not been for that non-reliance clause, what I'm saying is that I wouldn't have directed a verdict because I think there was certainly some evidence that there was material misrepresentations made, whatever." Now, given that the trial judge himself was certain there were material misrepresentations made, which in fact was supported by the appellee's own tax returns showing that they made under $10,000 a month in net operating income when they operated the business, not the $33,000 as represented to the to U.S. Capital and my client, Mr. Paju, it's important for the court to look at whether the disclaimer of reliance provisions, what they are, who was parties to them, and whether or not they're enforceable. And to
Appellees contend that the directed verdict was proper because there was no evidence of reliance.
Right. There was no evidence of reliance because the court found that the no reliance clauses knocked out that element. There was evidence of reliance in the record. My client testified that were it not for the business profit analysis that he was provided, if he had known that those numbers were not true, he would not have signed any documents. He would have walked away from the entire transaction, and that's in the record. So there is evidence of reliance. What Judge Wallace found was, notwithstanding that evidence, he found that the appellants could not claim that they relied because they were barred as a result of the documents they signed. And there's three or four documents that are relevant. First, And that goes into, when you look at these type of cases, it's basically a two-step procedure. One, there's a threshold issue, and this is, it's referred to that in every case, Italian Cowboy, Schlumberger, the threshold issue for an effective disclaimer of reliance is whether the contract language is, quote, clear and unequivocal, unquote. That's the first issue. So let's look at the documents. The asset sale and purchase contract and the bill of sale, neither of them, one of them have any disclaimer of reliance provisions. So they're not relevant. However, it is worth noting that in this asset sale and purchase contract, there is a full disclosure provision. So paragraph 2.07, and which is directly above the as-is and no representation provisions. So in the asset sale and purchase contract, it says, no representations made to buyer, nor any document or other information given or delivered to buyer, contains or will contain any untrue statement of material fact, or omit or will omit a material fact necessary to make the matters disclosed in the related documents not misleading. Now, at a minimum, that language is going to make a buyer comfortable that what he's being represented is true, because that's what they're representing as to the sale. Now, the other document, there's a closing.
In other words, but you're saying that because it doesn't say that he agrees or he recognizes or he is not relying, uses that language.
Right, that document.
That's not a no reliance clause.
Right, there's no reliance clause in the asset sale and purchase contract. There just isn't. Okay. But there is a full disclosure clause saying that the appellee, Shell and Western, is fully disclosing. The closing agreement, that protects the attorney, the law firm, the title company. It's not a document between the parties. It's made so that they won't come back and sue the lawyers, the title company. The document that we have to look at is the acknowledgement and hold harmless agreement. That's appendix 6 to my appendix, document number 6 to my appendix. And it is the only document that has a potential disclaimer of reliance provision. However, the disclaimer of reliance provision is not clear and unequivocal, especially as to the lease and guarantee. First, the seller in the hold harmless agreement is Shell on Western Inc. It's not Royal West, who's the landlord under the lease and the person to whom the guarantee was made. Neither Royal West nor Danish Pagy were parties to the hold harmless agreement. And it makes no sense that you could take a document to which someone was not a party and then use that to preclude claims. Second, the hold harmless agreement relates to a contract for the sale of real property, which never closed, and it relates to an asset sale, which did close, but again, it benefited Shell on Western, Inc. It did not relate to Royal West. Therefore, it cannot be disputed that at most, these disclaimers in the hold harmless agreement can relate only to claims against Shell on Western, Inc. Shell on Western, Inc. sued my client and recovered nothing from the jury. However, my client was not even allowed to submit questions as to Shell on Western, Inc. on the basis of this hold harmless clause or hold harmless agreement. That may or may not be correct as to Shell on Western, Inc., and we'll talk about that later. But it cannot be correct as to Royal West, who was not a party. Royal West was the party to the lease and the guarantee. There are no documents disclaiming reliance in favor of Royal West. There's zero. If you look at the lease itself, the only no reliance provision in the lease relates to the use of the lease premises or property. Doesn't have anything as to income or any other representations. Similarly, the guarantee is a very simple guarantee. It doesn't incorporate the lease like some do. It doesn't have any waivers of reliance or no representation provisions whatsoever. Therefore, when you look at the threshold issue of whether the disclaimer of reliance was clear and unequivocal. The answer is absolutely not as to Royal West, as to the lease, and as to the guarantee.
So if it's not clear and unequivocal, then as a matter of law, it's not effective?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So that's the threshold requirement. Now, if you meet that threshold requirement, which potentially it does as to Shell and Western Inc., our claims as to Shell and Western Inc., then you go to this list of extrinsic factors the courts consider. And this is in the Italian Cowboy case, it's in the Schlumberger case, it's in the Forest Oil case. And in each one of those, it says, even if a contract contains a clear and unequivocal disclaimer of reliance clause, that fact alone does not necessarily preclude a fraudulent inducement claim. Our analysis would then proceed to, quote, the circumstances surrounding the contract's formation, close quote, in order to determine whether such a provision is binding. You then look at five factors to determine whether or not you enforce a clear and unequivocal disclaimer of reliance issue. The first issue is whether the terms of the contract were negotiated rather than boilerplate. During the negotiations, the parties specifically discussed the issue, which became a topic of a subsequent dispute. So one, was it boilerplate or was it disputed? Two, was the complaining party represented by counsel? Three, did the parties deal with each other in an arm's length transaction? Four, were the parties knowledgeable about business matters? And five, which comes out of Schlumberger, is whether this agreement was in the relation to something at the end of a relationship. In other words, was this relating to a settlement? Schlumberger related to a settlement agreement. And what the court found is, well, you know, these parties have been fighting for 2 or 3 years, whatever, and given that this is how they settled it, we're going to honor that. But that makes no sense if you're at the very beginning of a relationship. So when we look at each one of those factors, which, by the way, is a de novo review by this court. The court's not bound by anything. It doesn't even have to look at what the trial court does. This is a completely fresh review by this court. Four of the five factors favor my client. First, Mr. Paju was not knowledgeable about this business at all. It's undisputed that he had never worked at or owned a convenience store, gas station, or restaurant. He had no knowledge as to what typical sales were, what was necessary to operate these stores, what kind of manpower was necessary. He did not know any of those things. That is why my client relied on Mr. Shabazi's representations as to what the business's revenues and expenses were. And again, my client said, if I had known these were not correct, which turns out they were about $20,000 a month off, triples stating what was actually happening at the time, if my client had known that, he would have walked away from the deal. No guarantee, no asset sale, no lease. Two, Mr. Paju is not a lawyer. He was not represented by counsel. That's undisputed by all parties. Three, the disclaimer of reliance and Old Harbor's provisions were boilerplate. They were not negotiated before or at the closing. Now, interestingly, the lawyer who drafted these, who was hired by both parties, she was chosen by Mr. Shabazi, and it was clear from her testimony at trial that she was really looking to protect the seller. Because that's what she does. That's who she normally represents in these transactions. However, she admitted at trial that the disclaimer language was drafted by her and it did not appear to have been changed by the parties at all. And she had no knowledge whether or not it was negotiated at all. My client has testified that it was not a negotiated point. It was exactly the language that she, boilerplate language that she put in there.
Mr. Williams, before you run out of time, I want to ask you one thing that you've not gotten to yet, but okay, is intriguing to me in reading this file and this record. Is it your view in representing the parties that you represent, U.S. Capital and Masoud Despaju, however you say his
Danish name? Danish Paju.
Danish Paju. That the Houston transaction, that is the purchase of the Houston property.
The Rankin Road property.
For $2,200,000 with a $400,000 credit is a part of this and this transaction.
Yes, it's a part of this transaction because they closed at the exact same time. Money from one transaction funded part of the other transaction. Money from the Rankin Road, $400,000 from the Rankin Road property is what bought the assets of the Shell on Western. And so these closing statements both interrelate. They were done at the same time, and in fact, the parties testified that from the start, that's what they were talking about doing, was a type of swap, where basically Mr. Shabazi ended up with the Houston property and $200,000, and my client ended up with the Shell on Western in Fort Worth. The problem is, my client's property was actually making over $19,000 or about $19,000 a month. Mr. Shabazi represented that his property was making $33,000 a month, but turns out it was only making $10,000 according to his own tax records. But yes, they were related transactions. They were negotiated in the beginning at the same time, and they closed on the very same day, and money from one funded the purchase of the other.
All right, thank you.
What we're requesting is that the trial court's judgments be reversed, and that we be given a new trial to allow us to present the fraud and misrepresentation affirmative defenses and claims.
All right, thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you.
And we're ready to hear from Richard Kelsey.
I have a moment to set up.
Surely.
May it please the court, I can understand why counsel wants to talk about only the two things, because there are more than two reasons why this opinion, why the judgment of the trial court should be affirmed. First of all, plaintiff made absolutely no proof whatsoever of the damages. Zero, none whatsoever, which is a proper reason to instruct the verdict. The second reason is that the documents contain a complete indemnity from the buyer back to the seller, which creates a security of action which operates as a release of any clause of action arising under the transaction. This is all briefed. It's all contained. Documents are all in your record. If either one of those is correct, the ruling of the judge was right, because the plaintiff did not present a prima facie case and doesn't get to go to the jury. Now, I do want to talk about some of the arguments that have been made, and then I'll try to go to my argument as best I can, if I have time to do that. First of all, that counsel wants to stress his interpretation of misrepresentation. And in an instructed verdict, he's entitled to do that. We obviously don't agree with that's right at all, but those are factual issues. So we'll assume for purposes of this appeal there was evidence of misrepresentation, just assume that. Now, that's not the cause of action. The cause of action requires all of the elements of fraud. One of the elements of fraud, which is absolutely critical, is you have to show that you relied upon what you were told and you acted upon that reliance to your detriment. So where are we in fraud and the inducement? And this is a real problem. I've read the 5-4 decisions coming out of the Supreme Court. I've read the 5-4 decisions coming out of the other courts all over this state on fraud and the inducement. And it's obvious there are two social policies at work here. We have the one social policy that says you shouldn't be able to tell somebody something that's not true and then say, but I have no responsibility for that. Okay. On the other side of that, and the prevailing law, is that, well, that's true except for one thing. If you have contractually obligated yourself to say, I am telling you as the seller that I'll do my own due diligence. I'm sure you're giving me information. And yes, I may believe that information. You may actually have misrepresented it to me. But it doesn't matter as far as the contract is concerned, because I contracted that it was not the reliance. Now, that balances the equity problem with the legal problem. The law is the legal problem under contract. The equity is somehow that isn't fair. And if you read all the decisions on fraud and the inducement, you can see this constant fight in the opinions as to which is going to win one way or the other. A lot of 5-4 decisions. Well, right now, the majority decisions are all that if a non-reliance clause is contained in the contract documents, it's apparent on its face that that's what it does, then that is going to bar any fraud action. Why? Because there's no reliance. Why? As a matter of law. Now, the question of no reliance is a question of law and not a question of fact. It never goes to the jury whether there was reliance. If it, unless it gets past the gatekeeper provision of the trial judge. In the gatekeeper provision is the judge is required to construe and apply the contract as a matter of law. Construction of a contract, application of that construction to the undisputed facts is not a fact question. It is a law question. What I've wrestled with in this appeal and as we briefed is, what happens when the trial judge is given a question which has factual background, which are the elements that have been discussed, but the judge nevertheless construes the contract as creating a valid no-reliance clause? How does this court then review that? And I think the cases say that this court should defer to the factual aspect of that determination by the trial judge. He saw the witnesses. He saw everything that happened in the trial, and yet he is the one that has to assimilate the totality of the facts.
So your position is that this court's bound by a decision in a trial court on a matter of law by certain facts that might have been presented in the trial court?
No, Your Honor, that's too broad. What I'm saying is that where there is a factual determination of the aggregation of the facts that the trial judge must consider, only if he is patently wrong on those facts, then at that point, this court, if I review the cases, are talking about de novo appeal, and I believe that's what the cases say. They say this court reviews any of these, whether it's a special appearance, whatever it is that involves a factual determination. The old venue cases all say the same thing, that if it involves a factual determination, this court then should defer to the trial judge in those factual aspects of the ruling on the question of law, unless they believe that they are patently incorrect or that his conclusion is patently incorrect.
I don't see how that's not your attempt or your suggestion that the law binds the de novo consideration on the part of this court as to the questions of the applicability of a reliance clause or an as-is clause in contrast to the case law dealing with the fraud in the inducement. Because if your suggestion is that we're bound by the judge's factual determinations in granting a directed verdict as to the issue 8 and as to the disregarding of the jury's answers to other issues, then that's taking away our de novo review.
Your Honor, I don't think that's quite right, because I think what happens is that what this court does is it looks at the totality of the facts. That's what this court is required to do. And then you look at the way the trial court interpreted those facts and applied those facts to the law and applied them to the contractual rights of the parties.
Well,
now,
I'm sorry, Mr. Kelsey.
Excuse me.
When you're arguing a factual determination made by the trial court, and then we had a jury trial with a full submission of issues and full answers to issues, and then some of those issues disregarded, and then the question on a matter of law under the case law saying that we're not to look at what the trial judge did as binding on us when we're doing a de novo review of the matters of law. I just don't see how we get to a summation of facts binding our review. And I'm not, maybe I just have to disagree with you about that, then let us go on, because I see you're staunch in your view of it. But let me ask you a question in a different
yes, sir.
Way. Look at the document. And I might say that it would be my view that this, that the lawyers could have got involved in this case a whole lot earlier.
Which documents, Your Honor?
The plaintiff's Exhibit 3 that's attached as Exhibit number 5 to the appellant's brief. It's also attached to yours, but I don't have tabs for yours, so I'm looking at the one behind the appellant's brief.
I have it, Your Honor.
It calls for a sales transaction in which the consideration, looking on page 2 of 7, is supposed to be $400,000 cash at closing, in cash or by certified cashier's check on the closing date. That's the consideration. And that didn't happen, did it?
Did not.
And so when we get into a question of unequivocal certainty, this document starts out with a statement about an event that's required to occur that didn't happen.
That is absolutely correct. It did not.
And in terms of how the $400,000 was ultimately resolved, according to the testimony in the record, was that the property in Houston was also put on the table with a purchase price of $2 million and a $400,000 credit.
Your Honor, that's true. And I know the court is always aware of how do you get to a $50,000 dog, you trade two $25,000 cats. That's kind of what happened in this case, that they traded two $25,000 cats and called them a $400,000 transaction. That is correct. The $400,000 was never, ever paid. And what I think I want to direct the court to on counsel's argument a moment ago about the representation clause in that this contract you're looking at is, if you follow that all the way through the contract, and I briefed this in section 5.01, then what that says is that all this information that you've given me has to be accurate in all material respects as of the closing date. So if it's not accurate, I don't have to close. But that does not resolve the question of what happens if you go ahead and do your due diligence. You say that I'm not relying on anything you tell me. So then you get into the dig and you dig into the transaction. You say, wait a minute. I don't think this thing's making the profit that it was supposed to make, so I'm not going to close. And that's what this document does. Counsel, I think, misleads the court when he says that the misrepresentation carries past the closing, because according to the terms of the contract, it does not.
Hold it. Excuse me. You're talking about Section 5.01 being a no-reliance clause? Disclaimer of reliance?
No, what I'm saying is that it's no reliance past the closing.
Okay.
I'm saying that there is no, but the point is that it's a cancellation clause. It's an escape clause for the buyer. If the buyer doesn't like the transaction because they don't think the information is accurate, they can walk off from the closing with no liability whatsoever. And I think that's what 5.1 says.
I'm sorry, I don't see that.
All right, John. Let me try to one more time here. It says on line 3, if this information is other information shall be true in all respects as of the time of closing, the closing date. So that's quoting directly out of the contract 5.01. This is in our brief where we've covered it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me try to move on a little bit more, because I do think that this court doesn't have to get mired down in all of the problems about the no reliance clauses. They're all quoted verbatim. They're about as plain as you can make them. This court in the Matlock Place opinion used a lot less language than this to sustain a no reliance clause. And I don't know what counsel couldn't understand or his client couldn't understand, which says, I'm not relying on anything now or in the future about the transaction, because those were the closing documents. They weren't the contract pre-closing documents. They were the closing documents, which dovetail with the earlier document that says, if it's not right, if you're not happy that we're honest in our representations, then you don't have to close. But having closed, you can't come back on top of us, which is, if all those other cases that are out there talk about why that is so important in the marketplace, because otherwise you can just avoid any contract. Yeah. Fraud in the inducement opens the door to void any contract under any circumstances unless the no reliance clause applies. One of the things that bothers me about those line of cases, and I don't want to get too academic, is, but why can't the buyer then go to the seller at the time of contract and say, you sign a clause with me that says everything you're telling me is absolutely accurate and correct, and you warrant that information. That's in lots of contracts. But what happens when they don't do that? And then there's a no reliance clause. That's part of their due diligence. They gave that up when they signed that contract, and that's exactly what the cases say. I do want to move to, I've got hardly any time at all. Please take a look at Volume 3, pages 35 through 38 in the Statement of Facts. This is the only testimony on damages. I cross-examined their witness, and he said, were you ever asked to do everything you needed to do to offer your opinion? I believe this has been asked and answered several times. But the answer is, I was asked to do one part, and that was to look at the profit projection versus what the profits were made. That's all I was asked to do. You can ask it 20 different ways, but that's all I was asked to do. And we briefed this extensively. The case law says that is not benefit of the bargain damages. There is no evidence of damage.
Because well, I have another question before you quit. Why don't you look on your brief, page 25 of 28. And I'm talking now about the language that's in the last paragraph above the conclusion in which the statement is made that U.S. Capital never requested any jury instructions for negligent misrepresentation. Was that just simply an error on your part?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And I apologize for that. I apologize to the court for that. That is an error. They okay. were requested.
All right. Thank you.
I have a question, one last question. This relates to something you said earlier. Mr. Shabazi doesn't contend that he didn't get the $400,000 worth of credit. Does he?
No, and the closing okay. statement shows that. The okay. closing statement shows the $400,000 credit on which they closed.
All right.
That's why that did not appear to me to be a big issue. Sure, it changed the contract around. There's nothing formalizing that, but that's in fact what they did.
Okay.
I'm about to run out of time. I'd be happy to answer any question the court might have. Our position is this should be affirmed because the no-reliance clause takes care of that issue. There's no proof of damages whatsoever. None, zero. And they've never offered any in their briefs. Okay, second and the third reason is the security of damages issue, people just kind of laugh at that. But actually the case law says that if you indemnify against a cause of action that you bring, that is a security of action, and that releases the cause of action. We pleaded it, we proved it, there's no factual issue about it. It ought to operate as a complete bar. And it's time for me to quit. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelsey. And so we'll have a rebuttal from Mr. Williams.
Mr. Williams, before you start, and I'm sorry to ask you a question while you're just trying to get your thoughts ready, but I'd like for you to give me one bit of analysis from the trial record. I know you were counsel at trial as well as on appeal. And in terms of the presentation at trial, what evidence was adduced as to why your client occupied and possessed and operated this business for a couple, 2.5 years before getting involved with the suit claiming fraud in the inducement of the contract?
My client had over $500,000 in this deal. He wanted this to work. He got in, he realized the numbers weren't as high as they were supposed to be. He's trying to figure out why. He eventually talks to the manager, and the manager says, oh, well, those were never the numbers. And that's when he first realized there was a problem. However, he kept putting money in it. I mean, my client and the manager both testified that my client came out of pocket $8,000 to $25,000 a month to keep this thing open. Because it's not just running the business, you've got to pay for all this stuff, and that's part of the damages. There were testimonies to the damages. There's, when the store was lost, they got $63,000 worth of inventory.
So your answer is that my client was just into this so deep with already $400,000 worth of credit on the sale, that was part of the same transaction and might be set aside. I'm just going to keep operating this animal in spite of my finding out that instead of $33,000, I'm only really getting $10,000 a month.
Because he wanted it to work. I mean, he kept putting money in it, making the store nicer. He got a beer and wine license. He actually, at the end of the day, made more money than Mr. Shabazi made per month. A couple thousand dollars per month.
Like $13,000 instead of $10,000 or $11,000.
Exactly.
And in terms of your client's position about the franchise, I'm very interested in the franchise situation.
Okay.
Because it appeared that the franchise numbers were for the sales at the church's chicken was supposed to have been a net profit of $19,000 a month.
Right.
And it appears also from the record that your client learned about the fact that there was a different owner of the franchise relatively soon after he took possession of the store.
After the fact, right. After the fact. My client and the true franchise owner, both testified that they didn't even know about each other before the sale closed.
But still your client attempted to gain control of the franchise and failed and then still operated.
Again, because he had over $500,000 in it. This $400,000 is not—it's not cats and dogs. It's not $25,000 cats and $50,000 dogs. This is money that gave Mr. Shabazi, and he admitted this at the trial. That gave him instant equity in that property. My client then buys that same property back from him for the same price. He then gets his full equity out. He got the $400,000. It's not just money shifting back and forth. When he sold the property back to my client, he got the full $400,000 in equity out at that point.
Sold the property back. Which property are you talking
about? The Rankin Road property.
In other words, the Houston property, your client regained control of whenever they tried to undo the transaction. And at the time that your client was making the choice to continue putting money in, realizing that the $400,000 was tied up in that sale that was a part of the same transaction, wouldn't all of it have been possible of being vitiated simply by the fraud in the inducement transaction, in the transaction?
As to the Rankin Road property, I mean, it's difficult. I mean, he's testified that he would not have sold him the Rankin Road property if he had known, because the Rankin Road property was a single tenant, pays $18,000 a month plus CAM. That's the best situation. I mean, it's a one single tenant, no responsibility other than collecting rent. He gave that up because Mr. Shabazi was told him that this property makes $33,000. And my client did not find out until he had that $500,000 in it.
I apologize for getting you off your talk, and I don't want to give you a little time. So okay. Thank you for answering the questions that I had now.
Okay.
Get back on your argument.
I wanted to hit the circuity of action thing real quick. First, again, you have to look at the parties. The only party to this, the Hold Harmless Agreement, was Shell and Western Inc. Didn't have anything to do with Royal West. Didn't have anything to do with Danish Paju. It was an agreement between Shell and Western Inc. and U.S. Capital. Therefore, it can't possibly be a circuity of action as to Royal West or to Danish Paju.
And it only applied to the business, not the lease.
Exactly. Mr. Shabazi set it up where his company, Royal West, owned the land, and Shell and Western Inc. ran the business. They were two completely separate companies. The asset sale was only relating to Shell and Western Inc. It had nothing to do with the lease or nothing to do with the guarantee. Moreover, if you actually look at the document, the Hold Harmless Agreement, and this is on page 15 of my reply brief, it talks about the sale of a going business, and it talks about the sale of property. Neither of those even happened. The only thing my client bought, which is in their own brief, is he bought the assets. So there's no circuity of action because, one, that contract doesn't even talk about the contract that actually happened, which is the purchase and sale of the assets. And, two, Royal West and Mr. Paju were not parties to the Hold Harmless Agreement at all. So there's no way that you can hold that against them when they're not even parties to it. And then it's to the damages. I did brief damages. I showed many instances where my clients paid money and put out money in relation to this deal. None of that would have happened but for the actions of Mr. Shabazi on behalf of his two companies. Is there any other questions? Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you both for very thorough briefs and good arguments, very helpful to us. Your case is submitted and you're excused. Thank you.